Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And my name is Christian Sager. Hey, something that people probably don't know about both of us is that outside of doing this show, we're both quote-unquote creative people.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
even in the show.
Yeah, well, in the show, yeah. We try to be creative as well.
You can't strip the creativity off of cats like us.
This is very true. But you are a fiction writer, which I always try to mention on the episodes that you're not on, so that you're not like somehow embarrassed or anything like that. But I try to plug Robert's books. And then I do comics. And in the past, I've done music as well. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. In fact,
you were in a band, right?
Yeah. And I had a period of time that I'm going to talk about in this episode where I dabbled with electronic music as well.
Oh, okay.
But I was in a band for a couple of years, and, there's this interesting thing going on right now that you saw when you went to the World Science Festival 2 weeks ago that is sort of like trying to come to grips with what happens when you teach artificial intelligence, or really, I guess the correct term is machine learning, to be creative, quote unquote. And like, how do people feel about that? And you saw this amazing panel where they had people who were dabbling in that, both in music and culinary arts and drawing. And then they had this psychologist on the panel too, who was like the skeptic kind of.
Yeah. This was a really good panel. I saw it live at the World Science Festival this year, and if you're listening to this, you can watch it as well, because this one, not all the talks are available on video, but this one is available on video, and I'll include a link to that talk on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But it was titled Computational Creativity. It was moderated by WNYC's John Schaefer, and the panelists included artist Songwen Chung, computer scientist and musician Jesse Engel, neuroscientist Peter Ulrich Say, and engineering theorist Lav Varshney.
Yeah, and so the four of them had this interesting discussion, kind of a back and forth about what they were experimenting with in terms of trying to teach machines to be creative, and then more along the lines of defining creativity, systematizing creativity for human beings so that you could somehow try to take that and apply it to machines in algorithms. Yeah. And that's where Peter Ulrich Say was sort of like the neuroscientist, not naysayer really, but just like he was doubtful, right? Because he could not see a way that quote unquote creativity as he understood it could be replicated, in machines the way that the other three were pretty excited about.
Yeah, I guess if you were thinking of this as a jam band or something,
right.
He was the guy doing the jazzy solos.
Yeah.
Like all the other three had really particular examples tied into their research. And then Say would come in and he'd wail a little bit.
Yeah. He had very interesting stuff to add
to it. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was great.
And it definitely brought some balance to it. So we thought, after you'd seen it, you said, you got to check this out. I watched the video, took notes. And we thought, this is worth us having a conversation here on the show about it, especially because we're sort of at the intersectionality of science and creativity.
Yeah. So what we're not going to do here today, we're not going to just replicate their discussion.
Right.
We're gonna spring off of their discussion, talk about our own experiences, own thoughts, and we're gonna drag in a few additional resources as well, and some additional examples to bring this conversation to you, and then hopefully hear back from all of you creative people about your thoughts on machine creativity, machine learning, and the future of human creativity.
So along those lines, Robert, like when you hear the idea of a machine being creative, how does that make you feel as a person who, like, you know, I imagine you're like me, like it's work, you know, mm-hmm. being creative, writing, drawing, playing music. It, you know, there's something that feels unescapably human about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I hear about it and I read, you know, articles or studies where they've taken a computer program and it's writing haikus or it's printing paintings, that sort of thing. I see that, and then I think about these stories of, say, journalism jobs, like local journalism jobs being outsourced to another country.
Yeah.
I hear about, the impact on manufacturing, the impact of automation on manufacturing. And that makes me, you know, try and envision this future or where suddenly you're going to have programs and machines that can replicate what I do.
Yeah, we've actually, exactly to that point, we've actually like encountered that in this business
mm-hmm.
where like people will occasionally come to us and say like, hey, you want to make your job easier podcasting? We've come up with this program that will do all the research for you. And all you have to do is just like, you know, print it out and go into the studio with it.
Oh, wow.
And you know, that seems really interesting to me. That seems,
I don't think
like,
I got that email. I got the one about where you're basically outsourcing it to other researchers.
There's but then there's also, it'll basically just pluck stuff for you and put it into a doc. This has been pitched to me before, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I've heard about is like, you know, some of our listeners are familiar that we do videos occasionally. The old Stuff to Blow Your Mind videos would be a good example of this. So essentially you punch in parameters of what your video would be about
and
this software spits out a like video for you that has text on the screen and pulls image clips or video clips out of a library to just make something rather than you working together with a producer, writing a script, all the things that we do when we make those videos.
This makes me feel like we need to be marketing our podcast as a craft podcast,
right.
You know, because
right.
it's like all the research is done by hand. Granted, you know, on a computer screen.
A lot of people don't know this, but Mark Maron, all of his research is done by a robot in his garage.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Like among the cats, I'm imagining.
Yes.
The cats,
it's a robot cat, robot, actually. Yeah. But yeah, I kind of feel the same way, especially like when I hear these examples. But then at the same time, like, so I've done commercial art before. I was a mm-hmm. graphic designer for a number of years before I got into the podcasting business. And I've done creative stuff where I've been an illustrator, I've worked as a musician, I write. And so the thing that I've learned is that like the one of the most important lessons I've learned about creativity is that you have to impose limits upon your canvas, no matter what like mm-hmm. medium you're performing in, right? Or else you're just gonna like stare into this abyss forever with like trying to figure out where to place your creative ideas. Because there's this infinite possibility of like, what could be right? What could be wrong? Which thing should I use? Which combination of words? Which kind of ink? All of those things. For instance, like writers that I've encountered who have the problem where they'll rewrite the first paragraph that they write over and over and over again and mm-hmm. obsess on making that paragraph perfect before they'll move on. And then they never finish, right?
Yeah. I've done that before. Like when I first started writing fiction, I was doing that model. And of course, the thing I was writing is still to this day incomplete from that phase of my writing life.
Yeah, I've been there too. And it's like, that's one of those things that they don't ever really teach you at least they didn't teach me very well, in composition classes.
Yeah.
Like, just move on. But when I think about creative machines, then I have to wonder, first of all, are they aware of what their limitations are, or are they just executing an algorithm? And how do they know how to make those limitations work for them creatively the same way that human beings do?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you start picking apart your own creative process, you can begin to see how a machine could do some of it, you know,
because yeah.
You were talking about it imposing limits on yourself. Like, I'm instantly thinking like, all right, I'm going to write this science fiction short story. Okay. Well, what kind of ideas can I explore within the confines of this story, this setting, maybe this type of character that I want to write?
Right.
And then you start throwing in other parameters, like what kind of stories are selling? What kind of story can I write that doesn't have a vampire in it? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount, you know, creativity is not necessarily this just magical explosion that takes place. There's a lot of computation that goes into it, and therefore there's an entire side to it that could easily be mastered by an inhuman entity.
Right, especially if, like, we as humans are able to go to that machine and input the parameters of those limits to it, right?
Yeah.
And say, like, okay, here's your limitations, now write this story, or here's your limitations, now create this music. And that seems to be what they're trying to do.
Yeah. And I know when I think about, you know, these various anxieties about, you know, future writers and podcasters that are entirely machine, you know, we all tell ourselves, well, they can replicate a lot of it, but there's a certain spark. There's something I have that cannot be replicated.
Yeah.
And we also tell, this is the same thing we tell ourselves when we're talking about human competition. You can say, all right, well, this individual may be better at this skill set than me. They may have a better voice or what have you. But there's something special about me. And so to what extent is that just sort of a self-inflating fiction that we're telling ourselves all the time anyway? And so maybe the machines will just swoop in and take all of our creative jobs.
Maybe, although I have to say, like, sitting down and listening to this conversation and then, like, filling out notes and doing a little extra research for this episode, it made me think about my creative process in a systematized way that I haven't before. And it made me really realize that, for me at least, I think, like, one of the big, like, jumping points for human beings being creative is when they start creating new tools to be creative in different ways. And we'll talk about that later because this is something they discuss in the panel as well. And I can't see a future yet where AI is doing those things, where AI says, I like guitar and I can write these songs on guitar, but what if I go over to a tree and I carve an entirely different kind of instrument so that I can get this effect?
That's true. That's a good point.
Sort of like meta creativity, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So we'll definitely get into the tools here in a bit, but before we roll on, I want to really draw attention to two particular ideas that came up in the discussion that I thought were particularly striking. And that will come up again and again as we roll through the episode. First of all, they kept bringing up this analogy of creative technology compared to the airplane. So obviously we make airplanes that fly faster and higher than any bird, but that doesn't mean we fully understand how birds fly, nor does it mean we can replicate the evolved perfection of their powered flight. So technology essentially gives us a version of the same thing that outperforms the organic in many respects, but also underperforms in other areas.
And this was Ulrich Say's primary argument sort of against the idea that AI could be quote-unquote creative, right?
Yeah.
Because airplanes are not birds, right? And so he was saying basically that then subsequently the software couldn't necessarily be human in its creativity. But it depends on how you define creativity, too.
Yeah, it's a great metaphor, and I think all the panelists ended up picking up and playing with it a little bit, and we'll play with it here as well. Now, Chung, for her part, she highlighted her own projects with creative machine learning, in which she there's some wonderful, like, overhead video examples of this, but she draws or paints with a pen. I believe it was a pen or something.
It looked to me like she was using some kind of stylus tablet thing.
Okay.
But yeah, like basically she, from what I could tell as somebody who does illustration, she was drawing on like the right half of a canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And what she would draw, the computer would then draw on the left half of the canvas, but it wouldn't just imitate her. It wasn't like, I mean, you can do this in like Adobe Illustrator where it just like draws the exact same thing you draw and you've got like a perfectly symmetrical drawing.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's not a mirror image.
No,
mm-hmm.
this was like creating its own thing, learning from her curves and lines.
Yeah. It was playing off her movement, sort of improvising with her to create a work of collaborative art. And so she argues that the notion of a robotic agent that creates with you, that dreams with you in harmony, is, quote, an underserved narrative in our culture. And I definitely agree with that.
She was, to me, the most compelling person on the panel. I thought they were all really interesting. There was something about her that I was like, this person's going to go on to do like amazing work, and she's going to come back, because she was relatively young. I can see her in like 10, 20 years coming back to us and just like dropping like some huge revelation on us about creativity and computer learning.
I have, you mean after the singularity
occurs,
she's going to show up and be like, I'm sorry.
After she's uploaded into the hive mind.
They chose me. I'm going to be the go-between.
Well, she was dropping some really interesting tidbits into the conversation. Like, she was thinking about the way that she draws based on competitive gaming.
Yeah.
Like, she kept bringing up, like, and by this we mean, like, you know, video games where people are playing, I don't know, League of Legends or Overwatch.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the idea that she was thinking about how, like, the AI in those games was compensating for the human movements or play styles, as opposed to how she drew and how the computer drew along with her. That's an very interesting connection that I would never have thought of before.
Yeah, that's a really great example, because you don't think about like this competitive model being applicable to a creative collaboration.
And you and I play a lot of video games, you know, mm-hmm. but I don't spend a lot of time thinking about how the AI in the game is compensating for my movements.
I have, the only time I've thought about this, and this is going to be kind of geeky and silly, but in playing pro wrestling video games, I've thought about this.
Okay.
Because...
Oh, because there's like certain wrestling styles that the characters have?
Well, it basically comes down to this weirdness. Professional wrestling is a simulated combat sport.
What?
So, yes, sorry, spoilers, but as you see it on TV, it's two humans pretending, you know, acting out a combat scenario.
We actually have a video about this on Kayfabe that you did a couple of years ago. Yeah.
And so when people make a video game of that, they make a fighting game in which two humans, or a human and an AI, or two AIs if you're doing a demo mode, are fighting each other in a competitive encounter using the moves of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, some players are going to play that video game just like a fighting game. I'm going to beat my opponent. But others will play it attempting to tell a story, attempting to get the most dramatic match. And in those cases, I don't know that any programmers have really gamed that really strange area of video game playing.
Uh-huh.
But like that's what I think of when she brings up this example. Like, here's an example of somebody trying to not only defeat an AI opponent, but to try and tell a story with an AI opponent.
Okay, so this is an episode where we're going to have a little bit of more digressions than we normally do because of our creative backgrounds mm-hmm. and sort of things we can bring to this. I have a story that I think can tie into this that we can then maybe bring back to this AI
okay.
thing. So a friend of mine is currently working on a comic book for a WWE comic. He's just doing like a short story, and it's about some infamous fight between The Undertaker and... Mankind? Is that the guy's
that
name?
That would be right.
Okay. And so I never saw this. I'm not as big of a wrestling fan as Robert, but when he told me about it, I was like, oh, cool. Like, you could do some fun stuff like that, like have them be in a slaughterhouse or have them be in a graveyard and they're hitting each other with gravestones or something, right? And he was like, no, we have to do an exact replica in comic form of this infamous fight they had in, like, I don't know, 1999 or 2000 something.
Wow.
And I was like, huh, that's interesting. But to me, that, like, here we go with limitations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the limitation there is so limiting that I don't see what would be creative about it or interesting, other than obviously my friend and his style and how he draws the thing, but he's not being able to express anything.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. Because it'd be one thing if you'd say, all right, tell this story, but they actually have magical powers. Like they're really, right. Like Undertaker's yeah. really an undead creature.
Exactly. That's yeah. how I was thinking it would be. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, this is the benefit of doing it in the comics medium is that you can actually give them weird powers and you can like really play with the goofy narrative of like their roles.
Yeah.
Right.
But then this also leads to the creative challenge. Like if the, yeah. sometimes just because the constraints are there doesn't mean there's not an opportunity.
Exactly. And that's what I'm looking forward to it because when I hear that, I go, man, there's too many limitations there. But, you know, who knows? Maybe there's a way within all those limitations. I trust that my friend is going to be able to do this, that there'll be like a really cool way to depict that fight.
All right. But it's going to take creativity. And so we're going to roll it back a little bit and talk about what creativity actually is, like boiling it down, reconstructing it so that we can understand what we're doing when we're creative in order to make a machine engage in the same process.
Right. So they come up with some of their kind of limitations on what creativity can or cannot be. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think like ultimately like the split between the four of them or maybe the three of them versus Ulrich Say came down was that Ulrich Say has this sort of broader definition of creativity as being this sort of magical thing that happens in the human brain, right?
Yeah, like he talks about at different times in the discussion, talks about the importance of pain, of intent, of consciousness, various attributes that are currently beyond the scope of AI and would be problematic if we had them. You know, if you could, would it be... This is a whole separate issue, but would it be ethical to make a depressed artist robot? Because what kind of cruel god are you to make a robot so depressed?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that later on in the notes. I have a question on whether robots can be crazy enough to be creative, because as we know, many creative people suffer mental health issues.
Yeah. So. Well, that's how we got David in the Covenant movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they already answered it for us. Thanks, Ridley Scott.
All right. So one of the sort of loose models, though, for creativity that is thrown out here is it comes from engineering theorist Lev Varshney, and he breaks it all down to a combination of novelty and high quality that comes together in a way that changes your belief. So like a Venn diagram, I'm imagining here of is it novel? Is it new? Is it something different? And is it of high enough quality? And does it come together in a way that actually has some sort of meaning to me?
I think this is a really interesting way to model aesthetics mm-hmm. that I had not thought of before. And when you try to like sort of lay this on top of like creative artifacts and see like how that works, it's interesting, right? Like the first thing I thought of, I was talking to you about this before we went to the studio, and no spoilers, but the new Twin Peaks is on TV, and uh-huh. I've been watching it every week. And as you would expect from David Lynch, it's wacky, right? But in terms of Lav Varshney's Venn diagram here of novelty and high quality, it's just the right amount of novelty and just the right amount of quality that it works for me.
Yeah.
Now, maybe for other people, because obviously creativity and art is subjective, it doesn't. But yeah, I was seeing it like, oh, that is the perfect, David Lynch is like the perfect metaphor for this. Cause let's be honest, like some of David Lynch's stuff, the novelty factor can get a little too big in that Venn diagram situation. And you're like, and Varshney actually describes it as noise. He says like, when either one of those things gets too big in comparison to the other, it turns into noise and we're no longer experiencing something like that's communicative. And he also says that if they both are if there's too much of both at the same time, right? Like if it's incredibly novel and it's super high quality, then it's just like that overloads people's circuits, right? So I'm thinking of like Finnegan's Wake, yeah. something like that probably.
Well, and it's going to vary from person to person because, you know, obviously because I think we can all imagine movies that we've seen where either, like I've seen plenty of movies where there's some great ideas. The quality's not there, though, you know?
Right.
Maybe the acting is bad, the monster doesn't look right, or whatever. And then you see the reverse, too. Some beautiful films, and you're just like, my eyes are eating up everything that's on the screen, but I feel nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Like you get the opposite too when like these things are too small in comparison to one another, right? Like if it's super high quality, but it's a story that you've seen and it's been done 300 times before, you're not necessarily going to be that engaged with it, right? Yeah. So there's got to be a little bit of novel something to it. But at the same time, if it's totally novel, it's this cool idea, it's like the ultimate Hollywood pitch high concept,
like the Ocean Walker hook, right? On Arrested Development,
yeah, something like that, and then the quality is just garbage. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's not going to do very well either.
But to his point about like both areas being blown out, both novelty and high quality, well, I guess one example would be if you take somebody who does not have much, of a bedrock understanding of modern art or surrealism, and you just really throw them into the deep end at a modern art museum.
Yeah.
So they might encounter a piece of work that is, you know, is highly novel, created with wonderful, you know, high level craftsmanship, but they're just not in a place where they're going to be able to understand it. It's just going to be essentially over their head, and therefore, like it's going to be a failure of the art in a way.
Exactly.
You may have created something wonderful and thought-provoking, but if it doesn't connect with people, then does it work?
When he says noise, I immediately think of the image of a television with white noise on it, mm-hmm. right? So the snow. So that for some people, that's what it's like looking at modern art, is just like staring at the screen while it's playing, you know, the staticky snow. But Ulrich Say basically argues that because brains and AI are using completely different processes, that he doesn't even know that you can call what they're doing creativity, right? Because mm-hmm. he's defining it as being pretty specific to human beings. And in that, human creativity is seen as simple problem solving by generating a lot of possibilities and then selecting from those possibilities. And this is how we evolved as human beings, right? So we went from using stone tools to axes to eventually Neanderthals using instruments and actually making cave art, you know, mm-hmm. like that process of evolution through our physical evolution also evolved our creativity. And he's wondering, like, if that topic selection, if that type of problem solving is even possible for computers. But where it really skyrockets, and this is what I think is most fascinating about creativity here, is when you start to imagine things that don't really exist. And possibly he was saying that this kind of creativity is due to the fact that we have an evolved prefrontal cortex. And in the video, you get to see, like, he shows you different images of various hominids and their skull shapes and how mm-hmm. they evolved over time, and then creativity evolved with them.
And then you see examples where there's cave art with like say a human with a beast's head. And this is something that doesn't actually exist, but is arguably an example of early creativity, creating these unreal things that then have various meanings and an effect on the viewer.
And then they get to this point in their conversation where they start talking about where the AI quote unquote fails at creativity. And that was interesting to me too, because they seem to be talking about how the machines were failing, but not how humans could necessarily fail.
Yeah, yeah. They were talking about how essentially in all of this, you're going to have this machine essentially brainstorming, but there's going to be a person that comes along, and the person is then selecting and judging the ideas. In the case of Varshney, he's doing a lot of culinary computation.
Yeah.
So humans are going to cook the food based on the recipe that the computer has come up with, and then they're going to taste it. And in some cases, it's going to be like, oh, that's a novel combination that actually works. I wouldn't think it would. In other cases, you would say, well, they would say, all right, well, let me slow down there, machine overlords, because this is not really all that tasty. So, yeah, you get into this idea where there are failures. But failures and mistakes are, of course, an important part of the creative process as well for humans.
Right. This is where, like, I step back and I was thinking about my creative process, because I was like, look, I know that I spend a good amount of time, quote unquote, failing on mm-hmm. every project that I work on. I mean, that's just part of being creative, is like doing a thing and then realizing that's not what it is, crossing it out, moving on to the next thing, you know. It's basically like what they were talking about before, where you're generating all these possibilities and then you're selecting from them. But you have to generate some possibilities that you're not going to use, that you're going to see as failures before you can eventually get to the thing that you see as a success, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody out there who has engaged in a creative process, you've come up with some, they can't all be zingers, as they say. You're going to come up with some duds. And for a while, you might think that dud is pretty amazing because maybe it is really novel, you know, or maybe it is really high quality, but the balance is perhaps not there.
Right. Yeah.
Now, there's also the notion of intent in all of this, of feelings, the later of which is obviously currently not present in artificial intelligence and machine learning. But perhaps we're just talking about two different sorts of flight, to come back to the bird airplane scenario. And indeed, moderator John Schaefer brought up the point of apophenia. So this is interesting. This is a concept coined by German scientist Klaus Conrad in 1958. And it's the opposite of an epiphany. An epiphany being a true intuition of the world's interconnectedness. And in statistics, apophenia is essentially a type 1 error or false positive, where you think something's connected and it's not. And in psychology, according to Conrad, it's the stuff of schizophrenia.
Right, and that's where it's primarily being discussed in present day, as like a psychological problem. It's when unrelated details seem to be saturated with connections and meaning, but those are false. They ultimately lead to nowhere, right? And I've absolutely had this experience with writing before where I'm like, oh, I'm totally on the right path. And then like I look back at it a week later, I'm like, that was garbage, you know?
Yeah, and in the schizophrenia case, this would be like if you see the same person on the subway twice, and you're convinced that there's someone following you.
Right.
You're making a connection that isn't there, and it might take on a pathological energy.
What's interesting to me here, though, is that I think this type 1 error definition of it is sort of connected to the idea of creativity.
Yeah.
It's defined as believing something is real when it isn't, okay? That could be said to be part of the creative process when you're imagining something that isn't real, at least not yet, right? Either like if you're writing a fantasy story and it's like, okay, my main character has wings and the head of a lion and carries a flaming sword, right? Like that doesn't exist. It probably won't ever exist, but that doesn't mean necessarily that it's not creative, right? But in this sense, it's the actual belief that it's real, right? Like that if you are like, so there's this angel with a lion's head that's following me around everywhere, the flaming sword, then I can see how that would be schizophrenia.
Yeah. So in real life and in statistics, this is a problem, but in creativity, as John Schaefer points out, like our brain engages with it. Our brain uses apophenia essentially to forge connections where there isn't one. And a lot of that is where we end up, creating something unique, you know, like, for instance, the whole why does a human have a lion for a head and a flaming sword? You fill in the details and you can reach the point where it's like, oh, well, now it makes sense.
Right.
I have sewn these two things together and now I have this complete form.
Yeah. And so when you make those associations in specific ways with different media, right? So like I'm thinking here of album art.
Yes.
Because you listen to the music that's the artifact that the album is ultimately for. But then there's album art that's created kind of as part of the creative package, but also as marketing. And ultimately, like, it gives you, there's connections between those two things. Like, when you buy them, and it's interesting to me since I moved away from buying physical records and I mainly just get digital music now. Mm-hmm. I realized that I had so many emotional connections with music purely because of the artwork that it came with, because of the packaging that it came with. And I wasn't simply just judging the music on its own merits outside of any kind of visual thing.
Well, so here's a quick question on this idea of albums and their album art.
Yeah.
What's an example, in your opinion, where the album art and the music like perfectly match?
Oh, you know what's funny is I was actually listening to this record this morning, thinking of you. Tools, is it Undertow?
Yeah.
Yeah. That like weird sculpture that's on the cover of that. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, surrounding that album coming out, there were like at least three videos that used that similar kind of like gothic claymation style, right?
Yeah.
none of those things were the music themselves. But when I hear that music now, for whatever reason, in my head are these like swirling clay sculpture forms.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. My example would have been Tool's Anima, actually. They're certainly a band that has always put a lot of thought into how their art and music are coming together. Now, that being said, there are plenty of albums out there where the art and the music seem to be on separate planets.
And you did a fascinating experiment for this episode. I'm thrilled about this, and I can't wait for you to tell the audience, because it's interactive. They can go and listen and look at this album art as well.
That's right. If you think back to our episode on H.R. Giger, we mentioned how he was generally cool with just about anybody using his art for their album, provided they went through official channels.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, you know, on the level. So there are a number of different albums out there that have Giger covers, and the music doesn't always match up with, or I would argue rarely matches up with the aesthetic energy that he possessed.
Yeah, with Giger, like, I assume that it's going to be something that's kind of industrial or metallic in some way.
Right. So what I did is I went on Spotify, I made a playlist with like one song from every album I could find on Spotify that had a Giger cover.
Okay.
Or in one case came out at a certain point with Giger art promoting it. So I then listened to each example and I tried to decide, all right, is this something where the album art makes sense for me? Is there an actual connection in my mind between Giger and this artist?
Yeah.
Is there totally not? And can I detect any moments where I feel apophenia kicking in and this creative process in my brain, bringing the two together, finding and forging the connections? So that's what I did. And you can do this too. I'm going to have the link for this Spotify playlist on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But I started listening to these. I listened to Emerson, Lake and Palmer's Brain Salad Surgery, which...
We were talking about this before. I don't know a lot about them, but I just kind of assume it's sort of like a prog post hippie band.
It's prog rock for sure. It's many people love them. I think Joe's a big fan of it.
He loves the Tarkus album cover for sure. He talks about that a lot. Yeah.
So it's a bit too jazzy for my personal taste. And so this was an example where I'm like, yeah, I'm not feeling this Giger, Emerson, Lake and Palmer connection. The same thing with Debbie Harry's, Cuckoo album. I'm straining to make that connection. The same with Steve Simon's Electric Playboys and with the Dead Kennedys album as well.
And I think on the Dead Kennedys one, because that was like so hotly contested with the PRMC, it was only in the interior. They have like a different cover that's like, I think like Shriners and like little roller cars or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
And then I think on the inside is that notorious, controversial
Giger thing.
Yeah. The landscape with a lot of, genitalia
and stuff, orifices,
yeah. So those are examples where I'm like, all right, no connection at all. I don't get the connection between the art and the music. But then there's stuff on the other end of the spectrum. So Celtic Frost, for example, that's some early death metal. Very much feels like a Giger soundscape. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Danzig 3. It's gloomy and dark, and you know, it has all this focus on. Weird ideas. It works. All right. I totally buy these album covers. But the one area, the one example where I felt things coming together and I had to like kind of struggling, but also I could feel the connection taking place was with a group called Magma. So they had this album called Attack, ATTAHK.
I've never heard of them until today.
And it has like Giger. It's one of these where Giger made the album art with the name of the band. So it was like a commission piece.
It looks kind of like his Atomic Babies.
Very
design.
Much so. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's some some safety pins in there as well.
Okay.
So, you know, very much a Giger piece with Giger's signature symbolism. And at first I'm like, I'm not really feeling this connection, but then I started reading about the band, French prog rock. Their album is, again, very weird. The drummer and founder, Christian Vander, he composed the lyrics in a constructed language called Cobain. And the whole project came together over an ecological, spiritual vision for humanity's future. And so I read about that, and I listened to it a bit more, and I have to say, yeah, I was beginning to feel the connection between the track No-No and Giger's art.
So this makes me think of, so you and I are old enough that we're seeing this resurgence with vinyl, and it's like, well, that's stuff that we used to listen on, mm-hmm. and then it went away, and now it's coming back, and it, in a way, it's novel and high quality, right?
Yeah.
but the vinyl resurgence seems to me to be inherently connected to this apophenia and to this like creativity that's going on in the consumer's head, right? And, my friend Charlie actually talks about this because he's a big vinyl fan. He refers to like having the artifact as the material oomph of a thing.
Yeah.
And I stopped collecting records because I was like, I have too much physical space. I can't carry these around with me anymore for the rest of my life, and moved almost entirely to digital. But so many of my friends are really into this new resurgence of vinyl. And I understand it, right? Because like if you're sitting there, like what you just said about Magma, you look at this record art, and then like maybe you look at the liner notes while the album's playing, and then maybe you go on Wikipedia or something and you read up on them. It creates this like series of connections that may or may not exist, but add something to the music.
Yeah. So to bring it back to machine learning and creativity.
Right.
To what extent is it a case of machines throwing together combinations till something begins to catch, till you have this Magma moment, and then the randomness touches on possible synchronicity, and then just as our brains try to make sense of it, we engage in the creative process of refining the machine-made connections.
So I'll just say this before we take a break, which is that whatever the first album is that's created entirely by AI, mm-hmm. it should have an H.R. Giger cover.
That's true. And if it's already out there, the first AI album, it needs a new cover by Giger.
As we talked about in the H.R. Giger episode, that house in Switzerland is just full of unused art.
So yeah, contact them, commission.
Go knock on that door.
Find something and get the rights to it.
Yeah. So, okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the effects of the actual technology on the act of creativity.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So in all of this, we're talking about machine learning and, you know, robotic arms that are drawing, computer programs that are taking the various, hierarchies of values within a particular discipline and then using those to create, quote unquote, art or fiction or a recipe. And in all of these cases, though, it's essential to point out that the technology is working as a tool.
Right.
And obviously creativity and tools have always co-evolved. So think of any great work of human art and you have to contemplate the tools and the technologies required to create it. The physical tools for carving rock or wood, working and firing pottery, the chemical technologies of paints, varnishes, and lacquers, the evolution of musical instruments, electrical musical instruments, and recording and producing technology, writing technologies from clay tablets to pens to the printing press, the typewriter, word processors, and beyond.
Yeah, and so in this conversation, the panelists are essentially arguing that AI... Some of them are arguing that the AI would just be a tool for humans to use creatively. It's not that the AI itself would be creative, but that we would be using it in the same way we use a guitar or a pen or something like that.
Yeah, and that ultimately it's not going to be any more destructive than, you know, the effects of the synthesizer or any of these various electronic musical technologies that obviously did not destroy traditional music or
cause Judgment Day.
Yeah, or cause Judgment Day. Like, they didn't destroy the artistic traditions that came before. They took the existing traditions in new directions, sometimes surprising new directions. They bring up the example of the drum machine.
Yeah.
Where when it came out, you know, there were people who were figuring out ways to use it where you're creating sounds that, you know, they didn't match, they weren't perfectly replicating real world drumming, but they were able to use them in novel ways that brought about some new sounds in hip-hop and electronic music.
But then one of the panelists, it was the guy from Google, I'm forgetting his name right now, but he likened AI to a garden.
Yes.
And he said it's where you're growing things, but you're growing them with intentionality. And that computer systems themselves are not in a state where they can reflect upon that intentionality yet. So does this count as creativity when they're doing it without intentionality? And it really depends on what you're focusing on here. Some of them were focusing on the process of creativity and others were focusing on the artifacts of creativity, right? So a computer program can certainly currently create an artifact, right? Whether it's a recipe, a song, or a drawing, right? As we saw examples of all three in this panel. But it's not necessarily engaged in the process. And so that seems to be where they're diverging, especially because for the latter, intentionality may not actually be necessary. You can make artifacts without having any intention.
Right. And to your point on the process, Chung points out that the process is vital to what she does. Like, it's really more important than the finished artifact.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the painting is one thing, but it's that video as well of her interacting with this robotic arm that is essentially jamming with her.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is really interesting because it forces us to systematize our own creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, you know, we as human beings like to think that our own internal system, especially when we're being creative, is not computational, right? But maybe it is more than we know.
Well, this is always one of those areas where you don't want to fall into the trap of thinking entirely of human cognition in terms of a computer, even though technology is always a handy way to try and see our own cognitive processes.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you don't want to you can't dismiss the fact that there are aspects of our cognition that are very much in line with the functioning of a computer.
Right. It's the same thing as a bird is not an airplane.
Right. But at the same time, they both fly, and they both carry out the same process.
Yeah, I think though, like the tool building thing is where it really gets interesting to me in determining whether or not computers are creative. Because for creative purposes, when you actually go out and build a new tool, for me, that's a sign that a creator has actually like graduated to this other level of making. Right? I think I referred to it as meta creativity earlier. Like, mm-hmm. They're somehow not satisfied with the available tools that are there. And they need to experiment. And in terms of that novelty quality divide, this isn't always successful, obviously, right? And it's especially fascinating when a creator balances the novelty of that experiment with actual aesthetics and creates like a new tool that other people end up going on to use.
You know, we were talking about William Burroughs and Naked Lunch earlier. I think the cut-up machine is an example. It was a novel approach. To take essentially like taking these paragraphs and phrases, and they're literally cut up and then recombined. And yet, when I've read cut up literature,
it's noise.
It's mostly noise.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I like it, but most of the time it doesn't quite connect for me. And when I've tried to do it myself, I've really not liked it.
So I experimented with it a while ago. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing was rather than just like doing cut up method, I guess we should explain what cut up is. So you write something with intentionality and then you cut all the words up into separate little pieces of paper. At least this is how Burroughs did it. I think there are programs that will do it for you nowadays.
Oh, yeah. Websites.
And you literally randomly paste them together so they form just ungrammatical, oddly formed sentences and try to see what kind of apophenic connections are formed by these words combined the way they are. The way I was doing it was I would do that and then I would look to see where there were interesting connections and then I would pull those out and put them in my writing rather than actually use cut up method to write anything.
Well, and that comes back around to what the panelists were talking about here. The idea that it is a tool, that there's still going to be this human at the center of it that's walking in this garden of robotic creativity, of machine creativity, and saying, that's a good carrot. I'm going to pick that one. That carrot looks like crap. We're going to leave that. That carrot was never meant to be.
So this whole thing leads me to ask a question that I don't think they addressed, which is if tool use and making tools is an essential part of creativity, right? Like somebody had to invent the right kind of crow quill pen to illustrate with, or somebody invented a particular style of guitar with pickups and the six strings and the exact kind of materials that are used in the body and the neck, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or narrative style, or even stoves, right? Particular kinds of stoves for cooking. So all of those things are actually part of creativity. Are computers then capable of creating their own tools for the sake of experimenting and being novel? And I think the answer to this would be that we would say, well, that's how they write algorithms, right? The algorithms are their tools. But what about actual artifacts that they're using to make other artifacts?
Huh. Yeah, I don't recall any examples of that, whether within this discussion or outside of it.
That seems to me like it might be a good place to draw a line of like when AI starts being creative, at least from my perspective.
But then again, I mean, I think of great creative minds and so many of them
use prefab tools.
Yeah. And they're working within the confines of their genre between, you know, within, say, literary norms.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in many cases, of course, you see someone sort of mastering the norms and then figuring out what new spins to put on it. But they're not I would ask, are they actually creating any new tools though? Or are they just using the existing tools in slightly different ways?
Breaking the rules, I don't know. It's interesting, though. I wish we could ask those panelists this question.
Like Cormac McCarthy uses a typewriter. I think he uses like an old typewriter.
Is that right?
To knock out his fiction. But he did not create his own.
Like, he didn't build his typewriter.
Yeah, one made out of like bull skulls and children's skeletons.
This is kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah, exactly. Like, but you could argue maybe that Cormac McCarthy had created a certain kind of prose style, right?
Yeah.
That is unique to him.
I haven't read enough McCarthy, so I might be totally off here, but like maybe he's like fiddled with narrative rules in such a way that it's novel.
True. Yeah. I mean, you can also look, go back to Giger, and we've talked about how he was using the airbrush. He did not invent
the airbrush. Yeah.
But he was using the airbrush in ways that, I don't want to speak to method too much because I don't really know much about the methodology of airbrush art. But he was doing things with it that no one else had done before.
From what I could tell from when we did that H.R. Giger episode, he was using ink and paint that hadn't been used in airbrushes before. Yeah. Right. So I think that might be part of
that. I think that would support the idea of using a new tool. I mean, if you're changing the tool, you are creating a new tool. That's something they touched on in the panel discussion at World Science Festival, is that one of the things about human tools is that they have evolved and we have evolved with them. Our brain, our culture, our language, this has all been part of the same journey out of the Stone Age, out of the pre-Stone Age, as we adapt these tools, we figure out new ways to communicate the construction of these tools, and then create increasingly complex pieces of art, technologies, et cetera, with those tools.
Yeah. So then getting back to limits, right, which is something I brought up really before even we got into these panels, is that, okay, AI can use the tools and it can learn the composition traits of an art and it can learn those rules. Mm-hmm. What we're questioning is whether or not it can learn how to break those rules. But when they're using a tool, they have to kind of figure out the same constraints on the system that humans do. And so I'm wondering if these patterns are based on, quote unquote, how the world works as we humans see it, then that's human culture. And we're just teaching the computers the sort of like mathematics of human culture.
Yeah.
And then having them replicate that rather than the machines looking at the world and kind of coming up with their own cultural interpretation of it. Maybe I'm leaning more towards Ulrich Say than I thought I would.
All right. Well, let's take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what it means for the future and also some more comparisons between the creative process and machine learning and airplanes.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
So you were really taken with Chung, as I was, I think. Like, she just stood out. I mean, everybody on the panel was interesting, but Chung just was really fascinating in the way she talked about her process and then when you watched her actual process.
Yeah, the second she said that bit about, like, the narrative of machines and humans cooperating, I totally agreed with it, because that lines up with a lot of what I've been thinking about with science fiction, is that we continually see the dystopian vision of robot overlords and
right.
And evil robots, evil androids. And I love all that stuff, don't get me wrong. But when I read Ian M. Banks and his view of the culture, this post-scarcity, far future, utopian society, living with computers, basically having this sort of hybrid cultural scenario with super intelligent machines, like, it makes me think, well, we should have more of that. We should have more of this side of the argument. For a post-singularity world, and not to say that we shouldn't be concerned about the potential dire consequences. I mean, obviously, to whatever extent it's practical, we should try to avoid Terminator scenarios. but there's this whole other side. There's this view of the machine as a tool. This machine is a collaborative process. And I think that's very important to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I totally admire their intention, but I wonder if there is a point where it's really down to, like, sort of what our linguistic definitions are here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be a little bit of confusing collaboration for tool building.
Like, okay.
Is the machine actually collaborating with Chung, or was she building a new tool that she could use to create new art with?
Yeah, because you could argue that in the same way that a French horn, you buzz your air into one end, and the technology of the horn allows a different sound to come out.
Yeah.
So you could say that that's what she's doing here. She's essentially blowing into a horn, and we're appreciating the duality of her organic sound
right.
and then the manufactured sound of the horn.
Right. It's like she's developed a new instrument, and she's learning how to play it.
Yeah. And I think that's a valid read on what's going on as well. Now, in all of this, Jesse Engel, the computer scientist, musician, he spoke a bit about the Google Magenta project that he's involved with. And he pointed out that with Magenta, there's always a human in the process. Because, again, the human is a tool. This is the gardener walking amid the creative machines in the garden.
Right. This isn't Soylent Green. It's not like right. Google is made of people.
Right. But I found this particularly interesting because it closely mirrors the inner workings of military drones. So a few years back, I spoke with this guy, Noel Sharkley, who's a professor of artificial intelligence and robotics at the University of Sheffield. And he had some interesting revelations about the necessary human components of UAVs, of unmanned aerial vehicles.
Okay.
He said, quote, these are all man-in-the-loop systems, which means essentially there's someone controls the applications of lethal force. They're not exactly remote control. They're sort of a hybrid. They have certain autonomous functions, meaning they can be programmed to react to their GPS so they can go about on their own. They can navigate themselves, though a pilot will control their height and that sort of thing. It's the first step towards full autonomy. The most recent U.S. Air Force documents describe a swarm of planes. The term swarm is kind of a technical term in robotics, meaning a bunch of robots that interact with one another on a local basis. The man on the loop would be in executive control of the swarm. So rather than having at least two pilots in charge of a predator drone, in his example, you'll have one person in charge of a swarm of robots. So human technology can be used to kill people or create art as well.
Yeah, this is interesting, especially in lieu of the other episode that we're working on right now, which is, it's going to come out after this one, but it's about violence and the capacity for human violence. And drones in general, I think, are interesting in that respect because they allow us to create violence from a distance.
Yeah.
And there is sort of an apophenic, I don't know what the right application of apophenia is there, but there's something going on there with that, right? That allows that disconnection.
Yeah. So in the case of the drones, it's, you know, very much a person, you know, checking in and fine tuning everything. And in the case of, say, Chung's example of working with a machine collaborator, you have a similar case. So it's like a feedback loop process. The machine creates something, the human adds their spin, then the machine adds a spin on that, and the human adds an additional spin and weeds out what's not working and maybe adds some flourishes that tweak it for human consumption. And this is, again, what Jesse Engel compared to tending a garden.
Right, yeah.
You know, and this also reminded me of another conversation I had, and this was back in 2011. I spoke with Atlanta area electronic musician Richard Devine, who's a really cool guy. I'll include the link to the full interview on the landing page for this episode. But he said there were, at the time, again, 2011, he said there were more electronic music tools on the market that didn't exist when he was starting out, and it was at the point where anyone could really create something and put it out on SoundCloud. And he told me, quote, there are so many people trying to emulate specific styles, so now you have hundreds and hundreds of people trying to sound a particular way. I find that there is less and less innovation in music, but more and more people creating it.
Okay.
And he also talked about the use of algorithmic music composition, something that's been around for years. Brian Eno has engaged with it. Autechre, the famous IDM group, they've used it. Various artists. This is essentially where you have a program. You essentially have an algorithm for creative output, and you tend it like the garden that it is, and see what it creates.
But in those cases, right, at least with Eno and Autechre, they're creating the software themselves, right? Or with a team of people?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
So I asked Devine about this, and he said, it's really interesting because you're defining the rules and parameters of that environment, and then you can decide how that environment behaves.
Right.
But then he closed with the following about the limits of your tools. And this is key because it gets into what we're talking about, imposing limits. He said, I don't necessarily think that always helps creatively or makes people more creative. I think it sometimes makes people lazy. When I have too many resources at my fingertips, I have a tendency to get really lazy with the creativity. So for me, I try to limit myself with how many tools I use. I try to keep it to just a couple of pieces of equipment and learn those pieces of equipment really, really well.
Yeah, this gets back to sort of what I was talking about earlier about like self-imposed limitations. So this is actually interesting to me because as I brought up earlier, I did have a little foray in the early 2000s where I locked myself in my bedroom and made electronic music over a winter.
Yeah.
And the way I did it was with this video game for PlayStation. This shows you how far back it's going. It's the original PlayStation.
Uh-huh.
It was called the MTV Music Generator. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
It's branded MTV. And basically it was like the most basic way that you could create your own electronic music. It had like pre-built in beats and pre-built in like melodies and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And you could add layers of effects and things like that on top of it. But what I thought was really cool was you could take CDs at the time because the MP3s were just getting off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And you could put them in and you could rip segments off from your CDs and then insert those sound files into these compositions that you'd created using MTV's just prefab generator. And so I wrote like five songs, I think, and like put them all up online. They're I don't know. Maybe if the audience is interested, maybe I'll put them on the landing page for this, or yeah, one or two of them. They're silly. I wrote under the name Invisible Maniac, and this literally lasted for like 3 months, and then nothing ever came of it. But the thing about it, though, was that that was all I did with the electronic music, right? I never went beyond my CD collection, the PlayStation, and this video game that allowed me to do all these things. But the very idea of doing something like Autechre or Brian Eno, going out and writing my own software, or going out and recording my own drum beats or other sounds to work with, was like way past the point of my creative interest with electronic music, right? But I take something like writing or comics, the stuff that I work in now, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the tools that are available and the ways I can use them to tell stories differently. I think this all comes back to the systemization of art, right? So you're when you start getting to a point with the art form where you're so interested in it and you want to take it a step further, that you start figuring out like, okay, well, how does the actual form work? How does it tick? And then how can I take that and apply it in new ways? That's something really interesting to me. I mean, like, for instance, like when I played in bands, I never built my own guitars. I never built my own pedals. I have friends who do that, though. Like, they have, you know, little electronics backgrounds, and they build their own pedals and make music that nobody else has ever made before. And I feel like there's a distinction between us there. Like, they feel, it feels to me like they're more masters of their craft than I am. They go out and they build something new. Or likewise, for instance, like in graphic design, I have friends who are graphic designers. They'll go and write algorithms for Adobe software to help them make graphic design in ways that they haven't been able to before.
What's interesting from what we're talking about here is that it seems like in music, certainly, and then also in the use of Adobe Photoshop and digital digital art creation tools, like, they're many steps ahead of the literary model.
Yeah, so, right.
So we can try
the typewriter analogy from earlier isn't exactly right. It doesn't exactly work the same way tool wise.
Now, granted, we have fabulous word processing options out there.
Yeah.
We have spell check and grammar checks and all, you know, of course, Clippy popping up and giving us tips.
Yeah.
But imagine, I can easily imagine reaching the point where Clippy pops up and says, "Hey, I see you're writing a short story in the style of Clark Ashton Smith. Would you like to tweak it in this direction?" And I wonder,
yeah,
I wonder what it would be like to reach that point where you're essentially, you're writing with this machine filter in place, and certainly you can be a very purist about it and say like, well, that's cheating. If you're writing through a machine and something else is coming out on the other side, that's not the authentic process of writing. But on the other hand, how is it any different than buzzing into a horn and getting that song on the other end?
Right.
You know, yeah, we don't say, who is the great trumpeter, Dizzy Gillespie?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, nobody says, have you heard the sound of him just buzzing his lips? It's awful. It's all that horn. It was just, it's clearly the technology. It should just be Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet credited on the album. No, nobody's doing that. Like, you credit the lips buzzing into the machine.
You know what's interesting, though, is I think of like the media world that we exist in today, where, and you and I hear this all the time, content is king.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that just like the consumption levels for content are so high right now that like almost the human beings creating the content can't keep up, right?
Right.
And so there's all these like businesses that are trying to come up with a lot of like quick and easy ways to get more content out there. And this seems to me like a way to do that might not necessarily be aesthetically displeasing to the audience that's consuming it. And that's whether or not you're reading something in an RSS feed or you're listening to an MP3 file or whatever you're consuming digitally, having machines that can create content for you, I can totally see in like less than 25 years that being a thing. I don't think it will replace us necessarily, but it could absolutely be a way for, what's the word? Click farms?
Yeah.
For click farms to sort of create more stuff.
I tell you, another example that comes to mind is I enjoyed reading for a brief time towards the end of his life, Hunter S. Thompson wrote for one of the ESPN websites.
Oh, yeah.
And he was commenting.
His sports stuff is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But in this one, he just wrote about whatever. So he's often talking about politics and what have you.
Yeah.
For someone who wanted Hunter S. Thompson to essentially come back from the grave and comment on today's political news, you could conceivably, I can conceive of a future in which you have the Hunter S. Thompson AI.
Yeah.
And you just drop in the news feeds to it, and then it creates commentary in the style of him. Or maybe there's a human in the mix as well. Maybe not.
Right.
But, I mean, I can see people digging that, even though they know that Hunter S. Thompson has been dead for a long time.
What you just described, if that existed tomorrow, that mm-hmm. would be the news of the week, other yeah. than like, you know, big current events and things that are going on. But like, in terms of like media, everybody would be sharing it, and everybody would be like, look what I plugged into Hunter S. Thompson bot, and it came out with this. You know, remember that? What was the Twitter thing that was created that was like, Jonathan Strickland would know this because I think they talked about it on Tech Stuff. There was like a Twitter bot that was created, and the idea was that it would learn how to tweet from reading other people's tweets. And like within like a day or something, it eventually was just like swearing and saying like horrible racist and like mean things.
Oh, I remember that.
Like,
yes.
it was like super quick that it just devolved into this monster.
Now, along these lines, an example that came up in the talk is this Sony CSL Research Laboratory project where they use their AI Flow Machines system to create a new Beatles song.
Yeah.
So essentially, they just loaded in, you know, all the parameters of the Beatles discography, and then they created this song. It wrote this song, "Daddy's Car," and then they got humans to perform it because we're not at the point where the machine can perfectly replicate a recording that would sound like the Beatles. And
yeah.
this essentially sounds like a Beatles cover band.
Yeah, I listened to it, and it's very weird. Like the lyrics are written by humans. That's another thing that's important to distinguish.
Mm-hmm.
But the machine itself decides, you know, what the composition is. And there is something just a little, I don't know how to, like, Uncanny Valley in music, which
yeah.
I've never thought of before.
Huh.
When you guys talked about Uncanny Valley in that episode, did it come up in any other sense structure other than vision?
I know it didn't come up in terms of music. So yeah, I think this is an interesting example because when I listen to it, I definitely feel that uncanny effect.
Yeah.
But how much of that is me knowing beforehand that this is not a Beatles song?
Yeah, right, right.
So
yeah.
if it was presented to me as, hey, here's a lost Beatles song, would I dig it? Would I be all in on it? And then the additional question is, will we reach a point where audiences won't care?
Yeah.
So like I mentioned Tool earlier, I've had to wait for the last three albums to come out, and that's like a 20-something year span there. But there are new fans who come online and they're like, all the albums are there and they can start waiting on the next album with the rest of us. And if fake material comes out, we're not going to accept it.
Right.
I mentioned Autechre earlier. I believe Autechre is an example where there have been fake leaks that have come out where someone says, here's the new Autechre album, listen to it. It's really some other album that somebody else created. And everyone just, you know, craps on it. And they're like, get this out of here.
I could see that being pretty easily, not replicable, but like you could get faked out on that pretty easily given their music style.
Exactly. Can you imagine, though, a point in the future where the fakery, if you want to call it, or at least the AI, the machine creativity involved, is so advanced that they can come up with something that scratches your itch, that itch for, say, another Tool album or another Mozart composition, whatever the need is.
Yeah.
And maybe on top of that, it even customizes it to your own particular taste within that group, your own real-time emotional demands.
What this all boils down to that I think is really interesting and didn't come up in their conversation at all is, are you familiar with Walter Benjamin, or Benjamin, it's sometimes pronounced, his 1935 essay, Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction?
No, I am not.
It's this really interesting take on what the difference is between art and copies of art.
Mm-hmm.
And he throws out this term aura in it, where he essentially argues that mechanically reproduced art is missing this aesthetic uniqueness that the original has, right? So if you take the Mona Lisa and then you run it over, you get a like really high definition quality print of it. That's not the Mona Lisa though, right? Like it doesn't have the aesthetic uniqueness there. And so when you apply that here, I'm wondering,
is the art of the computer authentic then? Like, so for instance, they were talking about the recipes that were being created by the computer. If that comes out and it tastes great and you're like, oh, this is really good, does it have that aesthetic uniqueness of somebody figuring it out, or is it a mechanical reproduction?
Huh. Well, this brings to mind an example that also ties into my trip to New York. Is I kept thinking about Arnold Böcklin's painting, Isle of the Dead.
Okay.
In part because I'd just seen Alien Covenant, and they reference the painting in the film. Yeah, there's a scene where it's like one of the castles of the engineers, and David and Walter are standing out there having a conversation. And it's clearly inspired by this painting, the Isle of the Dead.
Which, oh, yeah.
Coincidentally, yeah. is a painting that Giger did versions of and in his own style.
Is that right? Well, that must be where they got the idea for it from, I would assume. That's very, like, when you look at it and you've seen mm-hmm. that movie, you can see the influence, yeah.
But it's a picture, it's an image with a lot of darkness in it, like, mm-hmm. like literal darkness. And there are some fabulous prints out there of it. There's some fabulous digital versions of it online. You go on Getty, et cetera. But seeing an actual version of it at the Met in New York, it was actually a little lackluster because there's this gleam on the black paint and it's aged a bit. So it was one of these rare cases where seeing the original, it felt unique in many cases. Like, here's the thing itself.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it was less satisfying.
Wow. So that's like a reverse of Walter Benjamin's aura. It's like the aura itself was diminished somehow
over time. And I should add that usually I feel the other way around.
Yeah.
Usually if I see an actual painting that I care about, like it's amazing to get in there close to it or as close as you're allowed and see the details, see the brushstrokes, see the physical paint.
Another example would be like the difference between seeing a band live and listening to them on recording. And this makes me think of synthesis and synthesizers, because in this talk, they brought up synthesizers as being like an early example, kind of like the drum machine, of this computer-generated creativity. And synthesis makes me think of Bloom's taxonomy of learning. And within it, synthesis is one of the modes of learning that you're supposed to try to achieve. And it's basically one has to put together parts from diverse elements to form a whole. So the process of synthesis creates a unique form of ideas, communication, operations, relations, and sometimes art. So while machines are currently capable of being synthesizers, right, they have a combination of those elements, but the humans are the ones doing the synthesizing. The machines themselves aren't doing that. So that role still seems to be held by humans in this relationship between us and seems inherent to the creative process to me.
Hmm.
And they sort of get into this a little bit when they start talking about ownership, because they brought up the idea that computational artifacts are actually not owned by anyone. Under current law, they're defined as public domain. So if a company can't patent what comes out of a computer that generates art, what's their incentive to fund further development of AI creativity? So actually, this goes back to what we were saying earlier, right? Like, if you were going to, let's say How Stuff Works built an Arnie AI robot that would write all our articles for us, and it was able to write like 100 articles a day based on like whatever it saw coming up in the news. Technically, How Stuff Works wouldn't own those articles because they'd be in the public domain because they're created by computation.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, this brings back to mind the idea of having a human in the loop. And so I could see the case where you'd have to have a human in the loop just for legal purposes, just so that there could be a definite owner, because then that human can have it in their contract, of course, that anything they create, on the company clock is property of the company. That's pretty standard. And then I assume the machine's contributions to that, the machine would be more of a pure tool in that scenario.
Right.
But a self aware tool, if you will, is just going to be outside of the confines of existing law.
Yeah. Yeah. For now, at least.
Yeah.
So, wow, we've had a pretty extended and a deep discussion about this. I knew that this was going to be interesting, but we really dove deep. And one of the things that I, to close out watching the panel, they sort of said, well, why are we asking this now? Why are we asking these questions about machines and creativity? And they said, well, because
This was actually, Chung, I think, said this. She said, we're currently generating these huge amounts of data, right? Like, just think of, like, our information systems just on the internet in general, mm-hmm. all the data that's being generated. And we're trying to wrap our heads around it. So we're using models that we're already familiar with. So in this case, the model of creativity, right? Again, getting back to systematizing it. And so human culture is being applied on top of technology. And that's what's interesting, I think, is like we've gotten to this point now where we're like, oh my God, there's so much information that even like we cannot process it and figure it out. We need to turn to these machines to try to help us do that, but we need to like layer our cultural understanding of the world on top of that.
Yeah, so creativity is not, it goes beyond just merely using these machines to make our art, but using these machines to make sense of ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess ultimately that's the point.
Yeah.
Well, that and like cat videos.
All right. Well, you know, this is going to be a great one to get some feedback on because I know for a fact that we have creators out there who create their art while listening to episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. So you guys and gals in particular probably have some insightful commentary on the material discussed here today.
Yeah, and we would love to hear from you about that. There are a number of ways that you can get in touch with us. We're all over social media if you want to write us about your creative experiments or your thoughts on computational creativity. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram.
And as already mentioned, we are a craft podcast, and we require your support for our art. So we're not asking for money, but we are asking for iTunes reviews. So if you listen to us on iTunes, or even if you don't, you just have an iTunes account, why don't you go on there and leave us a nice review? Throw us 5 stars, 6 stars, 7 stars, however many stars they let you give us. Just give us the maximum and leave a nice review. And that helps us out and helps us to continue to do this show for you.
And most of our episodes, all of our episodes, have landing pages on our website, stufftoblowyourmind.com. So we always recommend that you go check those out because they have like interesting links to other stuff that we've worked on that's related. But this one, as we've discussed in the episode, is going to have all kinds of cool stuff, mm-hmm. including that playlist that Robert put together of all the H.R. Giger album cover songs. So check that out for sure.
And as always, you can get in touch with us directly by emailing us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.